the differences in our contracts, which are minor overall. We have a lot more in common than we do disparate. So I appreciate having a strong Uniserv out here and having those locals in contact with each other on a constant basis and really keeping up the support for each other.
We, as an organizing team in the last year, had tried to figure out ways that we can be more in contact with and in communication with parents and community members. And something that started to develop was like a newsletter that would go out to families. And we were going to work towards that newsletter being a two-way communication street. But it hasn't fully gotten off the ground yet. It's still in the works. So at the moment, we don't have an awesome way to get like a more district-wide temperature on how families are feeling. But I know from just like conversations I've had with families who come in for back to school night or conferences, and other educators who have conversations with families that, like Sam said, I think they have a lot of faith and trust in us as educators. Like, I don't get the sense that the community doesn't trust us as the people who they're sending their children to hang out with every day. So, while I don't know exactly how the community is feeling, I based on just personal anecdotes, I feel like our community would be behind us. And it doesn't mean that we wouldn't have to do work to make sure that those who might be skeptical did understand why we were moving in the direction we were moving. Because there would inevitably be people who would have a lot of questions around why, because, you know, strikes have a big impact on the community. But I think we would be able to figure out a way to communicate with those who had a lot of questions.
Well, we could talk for much longer, but unfortunately, we are out of time. So I want to thank you both for joining us on KBOO. And thank you to Jamie Partridge for helping us convert this to a radio ready file. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 p.m. to catch another.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO. The cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Hello, and you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. Today we're talking with Aisha Beliso de Jesus, the author of Excited Delirium, Race, Police Violence, and the Invention of a Disease. Aisha, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Aisha, you have a new book out about excited delirium. This is a really big topic, especially since 2020, when we all witnessed the public lynching of George Floyd. Let's get into your book. First of all, if you could just introduce yourself to us and tell us a little about who you are. And then after that, let's talk about your book.
Absolutely. My name is Professor Aisha Beliso de Jesus, and I am the co-founder, co-director of the Center on Transnational Policing at Princeton University, where I teach American studies on race, ethnicity. And my research and background is really on, you know, policing, police violence. I look at the criminalizing of Afro-Cuban religions in the United States, and also have done research with practitioners of Afro-Cuban religions in the United States and Cuba.
Mm-hmm. And you've written this book, Excited Delirium, Race, Police Violence, and the Invention of a Disease. So what is excited delirium?
Yeah, so excited delirium is really a kind of controversial and largely disputed term that has operated as a medical diagnosis since around the 1980s. And the term has often been used or cited in cases of people who have died during police encounters. It was, as my book explores, it was coined by a medical examiner by the name of Charles Wetley, and has been invoked by law enforcement and other medical professionals across the country, and also even in the UK and in Canada. And the term has been used to describe people who are said to be in a state of extreme agitation or aggression, and they're often described of as sweating profusely and having superhuman strength. And then the people are said to sort of suddenly die around police officers. However, what's often missing from this account is that those deaths are often following the use of forceful restraints, such as hog tying people, putting them in carotid chokeholds, multiple officers piling on top of people's bodies, the use of tasers, as well as we saw with the example of Elijah McClain, the use of ketamine, which has been sort of touted as the way to sort of treat excited delirium, is to basically chemically restrain or sedate people.
There was a case in Colorado. Is that the Elijah McClain case where the ambulance service providers were actually charged?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So Elijah McClain was labeled an excited delirium, even though when paramedics actually encountered him, he was lying prone, handcuffed with multiple officers on his body. He was already restrained and he was complaining of breathing. And the paramedics, instead of actually checking him and talking with him, only spoke to the officers, and based off of the officers' accounts, then proceeded to inject him with 500 milligrams of ketamine, which was actually a dose that was too high for his body weight. And he ended up passing away from that. And so, yes, the paramedics were recently charged as a result of that and found guilty. And, you know, this is just another case of where the sort of use of this fabricated medical term has caused the death, right, of individuals, not just covered up the death of individuals.
What is the origin, or what is the kind of story of this syndrome? How did the syndrome become accepted as a medical diagnosis? And when did it start being used as a defense?
So the key figure who's known to sort of have coined the term was a forensic pathologist, a medical examiner by the name of Charles Wetley from Miami, who started using the term in the 1980s. And, you know, he was instrumental in sort of shaping the narrative around excited delirium. My book in sort of uncovers the history around this, the use of the term and how it comes to be hailed. But it's largely disputed from the very beginning and was not recognized by, you know, most of the major medical associations. So the American Medical Association and the American Psychiatric Association never recognized or acknowledged the term. Neither did sort of for the World Health Organization. And the ACLU and the NAACP have long been critics of the term. However, it was recognized by the American College of Emergency Physicians, as well as the National Association of Medical Examiners. And as a result of this, it allowed the term to be used as a cause of death, or medical examiners across the country began to use the term as a cause of death. And in many ways, it became the sort of perfect cover up for police violence, because once the term was used as a cause of death, then, you know, the police were off the hook, right? They didn't have to lead to any kind of accountability, because basically the term means sort of just spontaneously combust, right? They kind of are said to just have a heart attack and suddenly die. And so no one is to blame, right? They usually say that it's, you know, Charles Wetley in the early years called it cocaine agitated delirium, and it was specifically tied to cocaine usage. But then it was broadened, you know, to incorporate methamphetamines and other drug use. And so the idea was that this wasn't a overdose, right? In most of these cases, there wasn't enough drugs in someone's system to cause an overdose. So they were just saying that this was just sort of some kind of odd reaction to the body. And Charles Wetley argued that Black people in particular had a sort of genetic defect, to sort of spontaneously die on small amounts of cocaine. And, you know, it was really troubling because he made this racial argument that tied back to some of the early arguments from Jim Crow segregation around the policing of cocaine in the early 1900s, right, around 1914. And that was the precedent that he used to argue that Black people sort of go crazy, right, are on cocaine.
You've described the racist origins of excited delirium. How is it applied today in policing?
So, you know, since the death of George Floyd, right, where there was the attorneys for Officer Derek Chauvin, who was found guilty of killing Floyd, who kneeled on his neck for over 9 minutes, they tried to argue that Floyd died of excited delirium syndrome. And as a result of that, there was a lot of examination around the term. And actually, since then, a number of cases, such as the deaths of Natasha McKenna, who was tased and who was also considered a excited delirium, or Elijah McClain, who was injected with ketamine, and a number of other people who were similarly diagnosed with this term, there's been a lot of scrutiny and examination. And I think there has emerged a kind of awareness around the use of the term. And so there has been a movement, which is heartening, across the country to ban its use, right? So California was the first state last year to ban the use of excited delirium as a cause of death. And then we also have seen that in Colorado, right, as a result of Elijah McClain's death. And we also see that in Florida and New York. So there has been a movement to acknowledge that this is not a true medical diagnosis. And the two organizations that had provided support, which was the National Association of Medical Examiners and the Emergency Doctors Association, have both revoked their acknowledgement of the term. So overall, I think there has been a movement to recognize, and this has all occurred within the past year or so, right? So this happened since October of last year was when we first started to see this response, and up until very recently, just March of this year, when the final associations are pulling out of this. So it is a sort of ongoing question around its use. Nevertheless, I think what's important to understand, and what my book tries to highlight, is that even though the term itself is sort of out of favor and being discredited, increasingly being removed from its official use, that does not actually eliminate the medicalization of police violence, or the ways that police killings are still continued to use medical terms to cover up, violence against Black and Latino people. So, for instance, in 2021, we see Mario Gonzalez, who was in Oakland, California, died after police put their knees into his chest and was complaining of breathing. And still, the explanation of his cause of death was called a medical emergency, right? So even though the term excited delirium is not being used, similar types of claims, for instance, in Gonzalez's claim, there was still that medical examiner argued that it was methamphetamine toxicity that was the primary cause of death. And then we see in Texas in 2022, Frank Tyson was another instance similar to George Floyd, where restraint related, he was sort of asphyxiated by police while handcuffed and subdued. And, you know, again, Keenan Anderson in 2023 is tased multiple times, and his death was initially attributed to cardiac arrest and cocaine use. And Anderson, as the police were handcuffing him and trying to restrain him, was calling out to people and saying, "They're going to George Floyd me," you know? So what's important to understand is that the underlying issue of using medical excuses to cover up police violence continues, even if the term itself is not necessarily being deployed.
What has the reaction been from medical communities since excited delirium has been in the spotlight over the last few years?
So all of the major medical associations have come out and argue that excited delirium lacks any scientific basis, is not a legitimate medical condition. The ACLU, the NAACP have criticized the term extensively. What's really important, as we mentioned this just this year, right, the American College of Emergency Physicians and NAME, the Medical Examiners Association, both the only two medical organizations that had previously legitimated the existence of the term, have withdrawn their support and also come out against it. And so there has been a movement sweeping the country that has, I think in many ways emerged in the aftermath of the summer of 2020 and the deths of Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, to really understand that we need to have accountability and justice in both law enforcement as well as medical practices, and how, medical practices are deeply intertwined with police practices.
We're talking today with Aisha Beliso de Jesus about your new book, Excited Delirium, Race, Police Violence, and the Invention of a Disease. Aisha, the medicalization of police violence against Black and Brown people still continues. Can you explain how they continue to do that?
Sure. I mean, I think as I, was just discussing to you the number of cases that continue to use similar tactics or techniques, where you see people such as Frank Tyson or Keenan Anderson, right, Mario Gonzalez, continued to die during cases of forceful restraint or being tased by police officers. And yet medical examiners continue to place, the cause of death, or claim the cause of death is, cardiac arrest or methamphetamine use or cocaine, right? And these types of tactics are basically excited delirium without the use of the term, right? And that's this idea that sort of kind of heart failure through drug abuse rather than police pileup, right, or tasing of these victims is the cause of death is part of the problem, right, around what I think excited delirium has revealed, which is that there has been a large focus, I think, over the years where police violence has looked at police shootings, and obviously police shootings are sort of their own, they have their own scope, but what has largely gone under the radar have been restraint related deaths, right, asphyxiation related to restraint, or taser deaths, right, taser related deaths, and sedation deaths, right. And the reason why these deaths, these killings by police have gone under the radar is largely due to the fact that these killings are often labeled accidents or considered unclassified. And so as a result, they are really not counted towards deaths that, that we see, the police shootings kind of deaths, right? And so people don't always know about them. And in many cases, families aren't even aware of what happened, because the way that these deaths are recorded, often the only witnesses at the scene are police officers. And it's the way that police recount the events that, that we, so for instance, with George Floyd's death, right, we would not have known that he was not simply a man suffering medical distress, which is what the Minneapolis Police Department had initially posted on their website moments after he died, had we not seen the bystander video from 17-year-old Darnella Frazier that showed us the reality that he was, in fact, murdered by a police officer, right? And so the troubling way in which these kinds of medical excuses are used to cover up police violence really does obscure accountability. And in many cases, we don't know the number of people who have been killed.
Do you think that we'll ever find justice for Sandra Bland? And what role do police reported suicides play in the tracking of this kind of data?
Oh my goodness, yes. I mean, I think, I actually do write about Sandra Bland in the book, particularly when we think about the violence against Black women and the way that the violence against Black women has been sort of underreported, underexamined, and many scholars like Kimberly Crenshaw and a number of others have done really important work about, you know, pointing us into examining the role of violence against Black women in particular, and how we need to ensure that we are taking into accountability these intersectional dynamics, right, that make Black women particularly vulnerable to police violence, right? So for instance, we see it with the death of LaCour, who was a Black mother who was restrained and, similar to Elijah McClain, was injected with ketamine and labeled an excited delirium. And she was, you know, crying in a park. And why she was restrained makes no sense when she was probably suffering, you know, from a medical issue that needed to be attended to by proper care. And instead, paramedics labeled her excited delirium and injected her with ketamine, and she died. And so the question around the use of police violence against Black women, I think, is a crucial argument. And for instance, like in the case of Natasha McKenna, who was tased, labeled excited delirium, and then tased, you know, numerous times and died in police custody, right? The claim was that she was tased because her body was too small to, and the restraint vest that they had placed upon her was not enough because she had sort of superhuman strength, right? And when we look at Sandra Bland, you know, we see that, you know, there's a lot of questions around what happened to Sandra Bland, and it sparked a whole movement, a hashtag movement that, you know, say her name, which led to the reexamination of how Black women's treatment, both in police custody but in society, has led to the extreme vulnerability and their treatment. So I think it's absolutely a core part of this broader conversation to examine the multiple ways that the way that police violence operates is not just about, there's a spectrum from violence to abuse that use similar justifications. The question around superhuman strength itself, right, was one of the justifications for slavery, right? The argument was that Black African women had exceptional strength that allowed them to be better used to pick cotton in the fields or serve on plantations. And so capturing Black women, European slavers captured Black women with this argument around superhuman strength, that they were somehow more attuned to that kind of labor. And that then also impacted the way that Black people in the United States have since been seen, right? So yeah, I think that there's a lot of historical ties to racial violence.
Thank you. Aisha, in the last few minutes, I'd also like to just discuss another part of your book, another aspect of your book, which is you explore the Afro and Cuban mystical and spiritual traditions, which help to provide a foundation for Afro-Caribbean identity, both here in the States and the Caribbean, and how investigation into this played a role in the development of excited delirium syndrome.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you for asking. I appreciate the question. You know, it was interesting for me to have been studying the criminalizing of Afro-Caribbean religions, Afro-Latine practices in the United States, and, you know, doing research with police officers, to discover that the man, Charles Wheatley, who coined the term excited delirium, was a kind of self-proclaimed cult expert on Afro-Cuban religions. And I was startled to sort of uncover the history of how he kind of made his name, a name for himself as an expert in law enforcement through the criminalizing of Afro-Cuban religion, something he actually had very little background on. And I uncovered that he was exploring the or developing the concept of excited delirium at the same time that he was sort of working, obsessing around Afro-Cubans and their religious practices. And there's a really sort of interesting dynamic that I think happened, where there was a kind of collapsing and conflation around the stereotypes, these negative stereotypes, particularly around Afro-Cuban Marielitos, which are the people who came during the Mariel boat lift in the 1980s, who were decried as, you know, criminal, cocaine addicts, superhuman, sweaty, right? So all of these sort of terms that then get used in this diagnosis that this man creates are kind of related to the stereotypes around Afro-Cubans. But what I also wanted to offer in the book, as you know, as an anthropologist who is born and raised in Afro-Caribbean traditions myself, was a counterpoint to this fabricated racist perception around the practices. And, you know, I had been working for many years, you know, with people, practitioners of Afro-Cuban religions across the United States who have been using spiritual healing tools to combat, you know, racial oppression. And, you know, some of my community members were folks that were going out and, you know, taking up the ancestral ceremonial drums and going to sites where people were killed by police violence, right? So Mario Woods or Oscar Grant in the San Francisco Bay Area, and going with the families of the deceased in order to provide a kind of healing tool to fight back against these injustices, right? So I wanted to offer a counterpoint in the book to explore how my community and this community that I've been working with for so many years are using and advocating for, you know, different approaches to police violence. And I think part of the reason, you know, was to also offer a kind of healing pathway, because, you know, the text, you know, dealing with excited delirium syndrome, it uncovers and reveals a lot of violence and oppression that in and of itself is hard as a scholar. It's, you know, it's something that when, you know, when you uncover these cases, it can be very defeating. And so what I decided to do in the book was offer counterpoints through my own, you know, community's history, and offer, you know, these spiritual and religious Afro-Caribbean practices to show how people are able to kind of heal and come together as a community.
We've been speaking today with Aisha Beliso de Jesus, professor of American Studies at Princeton University and author of the new book, Excited Delirium, Race, Police Violence, and the Invention of a Disease. Aisha, if people would like to find out more about your book, where is it available?
So it's available on Amazon, or you can go to Duke University Press and order it there. I think it's available in all forms. And, you know, download, you can purchase the hard copy. And
thank you. And if people would like to find out more about you and your work, where can they find out more about you?
So you can go to the EFRON Center for the Study of America. I'm the chair of EFRON Center, and also the Center on Transnational Policing at Princeton University.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us. We've been joined today by Aisha Beliso de Jesus. Thank you so much again for joining us today at KBOO Community Radio.
Thank you so much.
I'm just human, got my faults like anyone, but sometimes I find myself all alone, regretting all the foolish things that I've done.
listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomas on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Election season is here, and at KBOO, we want Portlanders to be prepared to face their ballots with confidence. We've got a brand new limited series coming to our airwaves and your favorite podcast platform. It's called Running on Air, a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. Every weekday, your favorite KBOO host will be facilitating a deeper conversation with these candidates, so tune in. Find the full schedule on our website, kboo.fm/runningonair. Listen to any episodes of Running on Air that you miss on the KBOO website or wherever you get your podcasts. That's kboo.fm.